Okay, so let's continue with electronics, and we now start a new chapter in the book, well, in the materials, which is about internal circuitry of operational amplifiers. This is rather short, and mainly for just general information type of thing. So just to show what type of structures, circuits, sub-circuits are there in operational amplifiers. So we have already learned how operational amplifiers work. So we know how the ideal case works, and we have discussed about the limitations and the physical and real life op amps in terms of their frequency response and feedback characteristics and so on. So, as said, this is rather short, and it's mainly for information about different types of operational amplifiers. So they come in various forms. So we can make them based on bipolar or CMOS technology. CMOS stands for this complementary metal oxide semiconductor. So it means that we have both P-type and N-type MOSFETs in use. And bipolar operational amplifiers, they also have both NPN and PNP transistors inside. So they are always complementary in that sense. But also, the operational amplifiers can be this kind of a hybrid type. So we can have this BiFET, which is stands for bipolar and field effect transistors. So either BiFET or BiMOS. So BiFET means that there can be bipolar and then JFET type of transistors, and BiMOS, as you can assume and expect, it's bipolar and then MOSFET transistors. So let's take a look a little bit more. So far we've been looking at these operational amplifiers as kind of a black box, and just given the working principle about how the non-inverting and inverting inputs are related to the output, and then the limitations for the output, the voltage. So we have this supply voltage that limits the output, positive and negative limits for that. So let's look at how the basic principle of a operational amplifier. We have already touched on this in the previous lecture when we had these differential amplifier circuits, and then we had the power amplifiers in the last chapter. So in the simplest case, we could make a pipe in operational amplifier in bipolar technology using this type of circuit. So the first glance, it might look quite terrifying that okay, there's a bunch of transistors and diodes and resistors and whatnot. But if you start looking at the kind of piece by piece, you find some familiar things here. So the input states here, this is the long tail pair amplifier. So we have the inverting input for transistor 2, non-inverting for transistor 1, and then we have the collector resistors R1, R2 here, and then we have the current mirror for biasing the emitter current. And also what this does is that it effectively makes a high emitter resistance for this T1, T2, so we can get the high CMRR value. So this common mode rejection ratio is improved by this, by using this thing here. And then the differential input states then feeds, the output is taken from the T2 to the second stage, which is the output state. And here we have this push-pull amplifier that we discussed last time. Where we have T5 that feeds these T6 and T7, which are actually the push and push-pull amplifier stage. So this is just a driver for this stage. So using this configuration, the output is related to the difference of these V plus and V minus. And it's relatively simple thing if you kind of consider piece by piece. Of course, looking at the first time, it might be kind of terrifying that, okay, I have no clue what this would make and do. But if you look at them, like first take this part here and think of like what we learned about that, and then go to the next stage and so on, then it makes sense. So the output stage is class B amplifier. So we remember that class B was the one that had that these transistors, the quiescent point is so the active element, so the active transistors, so T6 and T7 are conducting only half of the cycle of a AC signal. So when we have a sinusoidal signal coming in, T6 is open and T7 is closed, and vice versa, depending on which stage of the period or the signal we are at. But you remember that there was some problems and things that take into account, like these diodes compensating the PN junctions in these transistors, so they are not they only work in a kind of ideal and case when we are having this 0.7 volt as a threshold voltage. So we need to have some more sophistication in real life in order to have a proper working amplifier. But in kind of the schematic case, this is sufficient. And also, we have quite a lot of these resistors still here, which are, as I discussed last time, in integrated circuits, you would like to avoid using plain resistors in circuits. So it's not effective way of manufacturing if you make a on the silicon bulk, you would make just a resistor. You would like to make some diode or transistor that looks like a effectively looks like a resistor from the operating point of view. So, but schematically, this works as a differential amplifier without problems, and it can output quite, because the output stage is a power amplifier, then we can get a lot of current out. That is usually the output resistance or output impedance of this thing is high, low, so we can kind of get a lot of power out and a lot of current if necessary. So in order to improve this schematic, this is the next step to improve. So what we do here is that we, in the input stage, we get rid of the resistors that we had here. So we, instead of having resistors, two resistors that should be exactly equal in order to have a well-defined differential behavior. So instead of having a resistors, we make a current mirror. So that basically the current that flows in the collector of this T3 is identical on the T4, and hence we have kind of a good control on the biasing point. And now we don't have the resistors, so we can use the same manufacturing process steps to make the whole this part. On the second stage, so the output is again still from the collector of 3, 4. So here, this R1 here is basically just defining this current mirror. So this T6 here is the defining with R1. It's the defining configuration for the currents through T5 and T9. So now we are kind of mirroring the current to two different places. So for the input states and for the output states for the base. And then we have still in the base, in the output states, we have R6, still a resistor there. And then we have this VBE multiplier. So instead of having two diodes, we have this transistor and then these two resistors that we can really tune the biasing point and the kind of compensation of this the voltages between this the base of T10 and base of T11. So depending on which side you go, you should have the same voltage difference. So to compensate so that we have this, the distortion is at minimum when we kind of apply a proper values for R2 and R3. And then we have this R4 and R5 in order to get rid of or minimize the variance on the or the variability of the current gain of T10 and T11. So this is already an improvement from the previous. So if you look at a real schematic or real circuit diagram of a operational amplifier here, we have a schematic for 741, which is kind of a workhorse or this kind of really common model for operational amplifier. Then it gets even more complicated. So so now we have different places, and we still can find the input states here, but now there has been it has been taken a little bit differently. So now we have a biasing to the collector in this current mirror here. But then the output is taken from the base of these two transistors, and we are driving this current mirror in a way here, and well, the output is actually here. So this takes the signal here, and then we have over here. It looks like a Darlington pair actually. If you look at carefully, so you have here a Darlington pair, so you have high gain here, and here we have the VBE multiplier that compensates. We can tune this part. Here is a current mirror also that biases this current here, and then we have the output is taken through here. So it's getting much more complicated, but still we have similar features that from the simple case. So it is just because in order to get rid of the variability of different parts of the circuit, even though they all these are made in a single package, so everything is in a single chip, silicon chip. And manufacture on a silicon single silicon chip, so all the transistors are made at the same time practically, and so on. So within this circuit, there's not much variability. But when you make millions of these, then wafer to wafer and part to part, there can be some variations in different doping levels and so on. So in order to compensate all those variabilities, it has to be made this kind of a little bit more complex thing that it actually, in the end, when you take a bunch of these devices, these amplifiers, and you start checking on their characteristics, they don't vary that much, even though the individual transistors might vary quite a lot from wafer to wafer, for example. You still have some variability, but it's reduced by this design. Okay, and then In real operational amplifier, you don't only have the input, so the inverting, non-inverting input and the output and plus and minus supplies. You have this offset null also that not all of them have them, but many of them have these kind of external terminals that you can hook some signal or bias, external bias, or you can tune, for example, here the offset of the output. So you can kind of have a resistor and tunable resistor to kind of really tune when you in your system you have the kind of the differential. So V plus V minus is equal are equal, then you should have zero output. And then, of course, sometimes because of the temperature or some features you might have at the output, there's some offset that it's not exactly zero, but it's something plus or minus something. Then you can tune with these inputs. You can tune it exactly to be at zero. So these are kind of these fine-tuning terminals that you can make use of. So it's not always necessary to use them, but in some cases when you are really need exact outputs, then you might want to use them. So here I illustrated the different parts of this. Here's the Texas Instruments LM741. So you have current mirrors in gray. So these are the kind of biasing circuits for biasing and defining the operating point for different amplifiers. So we have the differential input states here, as I already mentioned. It's a little bit more complicated that we than we what we have been used to look at, but basic principle is quite the same. So the difference, so the current is taking, the output is taking from here, so that output is dependent on the difference of these two terminals or the potentials are there. Again, we have the amplifying states here, so this takes care of the main amplification. So here we have the Darlington pair, which has a high gain. So the main amplification is done here, and then we have the output stage that takes care of the low output resistance. Again, going from another technology. So if we look at the CMOS operational amplifier, we start from a pretty similar case as previous. Now we have already taken a step from the very simplest case into the one that we already have here, a current mirror. So the simplest case would be even for CMOS that we would have resistors, so drain resistors here, and even a emitter resistor here. But now we have already taken one step further that we have the input stages is a long tail pair with the current mirror in the drain and current mirror in the emitter. So taking care of high gain already here, and then the output is taken simply with this PMOS amplifier, simple common source amplifier here. So basically, this transistor here. Because it's taken from the, it is in the current mirror, so this is just the current. It's part of the current source. So this takes care of the biasing. So effectively, this looks like a high resistor. So it gives a this amplification for the output. So now we are using the PMOS output states here. Instead of NMOS that we were discussing when we were discussing about the MOSFET amplifiers. But this again works as a differential amplifier, and it has a relatively high common mode rejection ratio because we are using these current sources. And if we would look at a what it would look in real case in order to get when all the compensation and all the fine tunings and all the kind of elements have been kind of tuned in the best possible way, then of course it looks really, really scary. So we have the input states. You can recognize that there's the input states. We have the differential long tail pair here. Then we have some Zener diode, so we could assume that that takes care of kind of if the current or the voltage tends to go too high at this point, this Zener diode will maintain that voltage at a certain level. And we have the current mirror here. Then we have another Zener diode over here. Again, it kind of takes care of that this point here doesn't go too high. And some capacitors that takes care of the only that the AC is going through, and so on. So it gets much more messy when we really want to make it work in a proper way. But you don't need to kind of learn how this thing works, but just to show that the simplest case, then it works. But then when you take into account all the possible problems and variabilities in different parts of the circuit, you need to add more features and things in order to get it to work in normal and in the wide operating ranges for VDD and also the input voltages and so on. Well, these BiFETs and BiMOS, they are not that much different from the previous. So basic principle is very much the same. So BiFET is using a junction field effect transistors at the input. Otherwise, we have bipolar transistors here. So bipolar transistors for the current mirrors, so the biasing and the rest of the circuit, but the input is used for or made from JFET. And why use JFETs in the input? It's just because it will increase the input resistance quite dramatically. You remember that when we are at the right operating voltages for JFET, we are in the depletion or the reverse bias conditions, so there is very little current flowing to the gate of a JFET. So in this case, we have a really high input resistance, which is in contrast for a bipolar amplifier. Where the bipolar amplifier, we have this PN junction, so it's relatively can be relatively low in comparison the input resistance, and of course. In order to the good amplifier is the features are high input resistance, low output resistance. So in this case, we can improve that. And why not use FETs all along the way? These bipolar transistors, they usually are slightly faster in their operation. So these can be the kind of the bottleneck for the bandwidth is in the input states. So the rest of the circuit has a higher bandwidth, so we can use this for high speed or higher speed application than if you would have everything in field effect transistors. BiMOS, well, basically the same. So we have at the input we have MOSFETs, and the rest of the circuit is in bipolar transistors. And again, the reason is that input resistance is high. And now with field effect transistors or the MOSFETs, the input is practically isolated from the rest of the circuit because we have this insulating layer in the MOSFET. So we have the oxide layer at the gate isolating electrically this the input from the rest of the circuit. So this is why to use. So again, the reason so the difference between PiMOS and a CMOS operational amplifier is that PiMOS is somewhat faster and has better frequency characteristics, so it can be used for higher speeds. So that was end of this chapter. So it was really short, but it was just to illustrate that well, one thing is that operational amplifiers are relatively complex systems, and they have the circuits inside are relatively complex. But then again, if you break them into parts, you can find relatively simple things there. So differential input states with usually made in this long tail pair, and then we have an amplifier states that can be made with Darlington pairs, for example, and then we have the output states that is usually the push-pull type or common source for MOSFETs. But so just to illustrate that it's when you if you see something really complex, a circuit, it's better to start trying to find some familiar points that you can kind of you already know how they work. And in these cases, usually it's enough if you break them and into parts and find these familiar sub-circuits and start from there rather than trying to figure out the whole system at once. So that was it for that chapter. So the next one is quite important chapter in general. So talking about noise and electromagnetic compatibility. So noise is something that is everywhere basically. So if we will talk about noise sources, how to represent a noise source using equivalent circuits, just to make things a little bit easier to understand and analyze. Then we will talk about the noise in different types of transistors, signal-to-noise ratio, so how to quantify the amount of noise in terms of in respect to the actual signal, noise figure. Then some words about how to design low noise applications, then discussing about electromagnetic compatibility and designing for this EMC. So how what are things that you need to take into account when you are designing and using some electrical or electronic systems? So it's not only about that system itself, but you need to take into account also the other systems that are surrounding that may either bring in some problems, or you need to take into account that if you are making a electrical circuit or electrical system, that you don't interfere other systems. So you are not bringing noise and kind of electromagnetic noise outside. So these things are important to take into account. Okay. So noise, as I said, it's practically everywhere. So you cannot get rid of the noise at any circumstance. You can reduce it, but you can never practically get rid of it totally. So of course the amount of noise in respect to the actual signal that you are dealing with and measuring That can be reduced, but noise is always present. Problem or the kind of feature of noise is that it's random. You cannot repeat it, so it's unpredictable in a sense, at least the kind of the actual values and actual behavior. So there's just some average behaviors that you can kind of deduct, but the actual values, like temporal values, you cannot reproduce. Well, I was saying that it cannot remove in digital signals practically, because you only have two states. So you have zero and one. So in there, in that kind of signals, you can get rid of the noise in a certain way. So if it's low enough that it doesn't actually affect the state, so you can clearly say that, okay, now we are at state one, and now we are clearly at state zero. So in that type of case, the noise plays quite little, or can play a little role. But still, if you would look at the actual state and start looking at the values, or if the state one is defined that it's somewhere, every time the voltage levels are above, let's say, 3 volts and below 5 volts, that is by definition that the state one. That's just an example. But if you would look at that level, there's always some fluctuation due to the noise. So just to illustrate what noise means is that if you have in ideal case, you would have a signal, an analog signal, something looking like this, the top graph. So there is some sinusoidal signals overlaid. So there's few different frequencies if you look at it, and amplitudes. So this would be the ideal case. But when you add some noise, then it can become this kind of a really not. You can still see the original signal features there, but still you have, in some cases, you are kind of having the features. If you zoom in and take part of here, then you have lost some of the features. But if you zoom out, you start seeing that there is this. You can kind of get the idea of what's the original signal. But if it depends on how much data you have. So if this is a periodical signal and you would like to know the actual signal, what is kind of buried underneath the noisy signal, then you would just need to average quite a long time. So you would just measure for a long time and then start seeing that where is the average value, and that would be your signal that is there, if the noise is relatively low. If the noise becomes in the same ballpark as your signal, then even the averaging doesn't help. So it's harder to find the signal, actual signal. So in digital signals, so we have these two states, zero and one, and as I mentioned, there's still some noise if you really measure the voltage at that state. But the thing is that we have the logic in digital systems is defined so that there is a certain limit that above which you define that, okay, if the voltage is above this limit, then we are considering state one, and if it's below some other limit, which is they are not at exactly the same kind of the limit for high values or high state and limit for low state, they are not exactly the same. So you have a kind of a voltage band when it's undefined. So you have to go through that band quite quickly. So basically, we have here in the middle, we have a voltage values that if the voltage happens to stay there or go there at those levels, then the logic doesn't understand what information there is. Is it zero or one? So then it's random. But when the noise is relatively low, so it doesn't, if this noise would be having a relatively high amplitude, and every now and then it would go in the middle part of here, then we would have a problem. So, and that's in the older technologies when we were talking about the digital levels, 3 volts, 5 volts, and so on, the noise was not that big of an issue. But nowadays, when we are the feature sizes have shrunk, the speed of the digital processing has gone up, the voltage levels have gone down. So we are now talking about in the order of 1.5 volts, 1.3 volts of logic. So we are talking about the zero state is close to 0 volt, and the high state is somewhere like 1.3 volts or even less. I'm not sure what is kind of the state of the art logic nowadays. Probably even much lower. So we probably are talking about some hundreds of millivolts. So there, if you have a half a volt, so 500 millivolt technology or logic, if you start having a 200 millivolt noise, then you start having problems, because every now and then the logic thinks that, okay, now the state changed, even though it didn't really change, but it changed because of the noise. And of course, it depends on in which kind of environment this thing operates and so on. Okay, then about the noise sources. So where this noise comes from? Because it's everywhere, but why is it there, and where it comes from? So of course, it's a kind of a philosophical question in a sense, but now we're just giving some equations how to define amount of noise present. So one kind of main or dominating noise source is thermal noise, also called as Johnson noise. So it's in all components that have resistance. So as you can figure out, it's all the components have it. So all the components have, one way or another, they have some sort of resistance. And so you have thermal noise. So thermal noise is practically something that is due to the thermal vibrations of charges. And higher the resistance, then higher you have vibrations and the effect of the vibrations in this kind of a random movement of the charge carriers. And it can be given like this, so that it's also temperature dependent. So depending on temperature, because we are talking about thermal noise, so it relates to the thermal movement of charges. So we need the temperature dependence here. And then we have the resistance. So it's the RMS value for thermal noise, the voltage, is square root of 4 times KT. So this is the thermal factor here. So it's familiar from the various equations that we've been discussing for bipolar and semiconductor devices and structures. And then we have the bandwidth of the measurement system. So because now we are, it's not only at we need to think about a, because it's a fluctuation. So there's some random fluctuation. So if you have a particle moving like randomly back and forth or up and down and so on, so it has some frequency associated with that. So it's not only, and because it's random, it's not always moving like it because of the thermal motion, it starts to move, let's say it starts to move right at time equals zero, but then at time equals some microseconds or nanoseconds, the thermal vibrations make it to go left, and then it right again, and then up, and then down, and so on. And it just kind of bounces back and forth because of the thermal vibrations. But the time between those changes in direction, they are not fixed, so it doesn't have fixed frequency. So it can happen after a nanosecond, it can happen 10 nanoseconds, or it can happen a microsecond, or so basically it can happen in every time, like, and it's everything is random. So that's why we need to look at a some frequency range and average, take an average of different so those frequencies, and not just one frequency. That's why we have the bandwidth here. So thermal noise is both white and Gaussian. I will explain what white and Gaussian means in a minute. So I think it's probably already here. So white noise means that we have basically the same probability for all frequencies. So we have white noise means that this vibration or the change in direction can happen in it can take a second, or it can take a picosecond, and it's more the same probability. So you always have a if you take a bunch of charges which are vibrating, some of them, or every now and then, a charge starts to move and then change the direction, and it might take a second before it changes the direction again, and another time it might only take a picosecond. So everything is possible, and they have the equal probability to have that happens. And that makes the kind of this it called white noise, because if you think about white as a color, it has all colors in it, so an equal amount of all colors. And colors are basically frequencies. They are associated with wavelengths, which are then you can turn it into a frequency. So if you have white light, it has equal amount of all colors there. So this why we are calling this noise as white, because it has equal amount of all frequencies. And the Gaussian part, so the amplitude is distributed as a Gaussian, it has a Gaussian distribution. So if you take the noise and you measure the noise and you start looking at the amplitude of the noise, it's less probable to have a big change and more probable to have just a small change. And if you just average everything, you will see that it's actually distributed in a Gaussian way. So this is here's the illustration. So you have higher probability to have like close to zero, so really small amplitudes, and then less probable of having high amplitudes. This is just an arbitrary units, the amplitude here. So it's not like 3 volts, it can be 3 millivolts, or so it's not this is just a Gaussian distribution. We have only the kind of the positive values, because Gaussian, of course, distribution is symmetric, so we'd have negative ones as well, but because we are now talking about amplitude, negative amplitude is doesn't mean anything else than what we have. Like amplitude is amplitude. So because we are not for the noise, because it's random, we don't define what's the phase of the noise and different components and different frequencies and so on. So we are just plane absolute amplitude. So those th that means that if a noise is white and if it's Gaussian distributed. So in room temperature, if you think about thermal noise, we can kind of organize the equation for that like this. So this square root of 4 kT, that's a natural constant. And in room temperature, it becomes this kind of factor. So if we now think about the system, for example, a high quality audio amplifier, which has a bandwidth of roughly 20 kilohertz. And if we have a 1 kilo ohm resistor, then that resistor would have about 500 nanovolt of open circuit noise voltage, which is quite small. But then if you would then have a 1 mega ohm resistor in that kind of bandwidth, you would already have an average of the RMS value would be 18 microvolts, which is still relatively small. So it's not microvolts is relatively small scale. So, but still, you can see that it goes easily. It kind of, well, it's square root of R. So it increases with resistance. So this is one reason why, if you remember the amplifiers and the amplification of different amplifier circuits, and it was typically related to that the voltage gain was related to the, let's say, a collector resistance or drain resistor. And thing is that if in basically would have higher and higher voltage gain if you would add more and more resistance. But then, well, not only that you would probably mess around with the operating point of in that circuit, but also you would start adding more and more noise in that system because of the higher resistance that you add there. And then you would have more noisier output signal. So that's why you have to make a compromise in those. So you know, don't want to use too high resistor values because you are increasing the noise. Okay, so how to how to represent these sources of noise in a circuit? So if you make a circuit design and simulate a circuit, and you would like to add, because of course, circuit simulators, for example, they are considering everything as ideal. So they don't take into account any noise whatsoever. But of course, if you would like to find out how in reality your circuit would work, and you will have some idea of the noise sources and temperatures and so on, you can add equivalent circuits in your design, which kind of takes care of or represent the noise parts of different parts of the circuit. So if you think that you have a resistor and you would like to have like add that, okay, how the noise in this particular resistor in your circuit would affect the rest of the behavior and the output signals and so on. So you just add a equivalent a voltage source in series with that resistor, and there are actually modules or components that you can add in circuit simulators that represent noise. So they just add. You can say that, okay, let's make a white noise at this point, and it will just add random values with a certain this Gaussian distributed amplitudes. You can set the maximum amplitude or the kind of the full width half maximum or something that how it's defined, and it will create new noise. and then you can see how it affects the output of the total system. Then another type of noise is so-called shot noise. So if you think about current, then you know that the current is movement of charge, and charge is primarily transported with electrons. And you know that one electron has this 1.602 something 10 to the minus 19 coulombs that it carries. So if you think about current, is not a continuous values of charge, but there is this granularity of carriers. So of course, if you have a lot of them, then it kind of you don't see the granularity of the charges. But when you decrease the current to really small values, then you start seeing whether there was 10 electrons going, or 20 electrons, or 11, or 16, or 100, or 110, and you start seeing that fluctuation, because you have this fluctuation is also related to certain extent to this thermal noise. But this has been defined and find out that this is actually a different type of noise and not exactly the thermal noise. So they have been separated, this shot noise and thermal noise. So this becomes a problem in low current applications, when we are dealing with really low currents, and this is defined by definition. It's dependent on the current, or the square root of current. And we have the bandwidth again, because again we don't have the movement of those charges is in time they are random, so we don't kind of differentiate, or we cannot say when they happen. They don't happen at a certain frequency, but they happen at random frequencies. So that's why we need to take again kind of a averaging in a certain frequency range or bandwidth. So it's two times the electron charge times the current times the bandwidth, and that square root of that. Then we can get the RMS value of the current or the noise. So the noise actually, in relative terms, or well, not relative, in absolute terms, the RMS value increases with increasing current. But you don't, the in relative terms, it reduces, because if you think that the ratio of the noise to the actual value of current, so this is the relative. No, relative noise, then you see that it actually reduces relatively. It reduces with square root of 1 over square root of I. So the higher the current, the less it affects the actual value, because it's increased, but you don't see it as well, because you already have the signal, the actual current value that you are kind of interested in. It's much, much higher than the noise. So it's kind of, you don't see the noise as easier. As when you go lower and lower, then you start seeing the noise, this short noise at lower currents. The short noise is also wide, and it's Gaussian. So it's basically the same probabilities and amplitude distribution as in the thermal noise. So all frequencies are as probable as any other. So as an example, again, if you have a system that or bandwidth that we are kind of dealing with is 20 kilohertz, So if you have a current of 1 ampere in that system, then the shot noise is about 80 nanoamps. So it's only 0.00000008% of the mean current. So you probably don't see that on top of the 1 nanoamp when you are measuring. Then if you have a current of microamps, the noise drops 3 orders of magnitude, but it's increased. So now it's 0.008%. It's still small, so you probably don't see the effect on your measurement. But when you decrease the current even further, then the current noise or the shot noise becomes 8% of the measurement. So this means that if when you go to lower and lower currents and measure really low currents, like in nanostructures or some even for the semiconductor devices, when you measure the leakage currents, and they can be in the order of picoamps or something like that, then the noise becomes dominating. The shot noise becomes kind of, you start seeing that more and more because that increases, relatively increases in your system. So shot noise, as said, because we are dealing with these like granular charges moving and the random flow of the charge carriers. So one thing where you can see quite easily is the kind of these p-n junctions, so that we have this potential barrier. So basically in p-n junctions in the reverse especially, we have relatively low current. So every now and then there is a current that has enough thermal vibration that it can exceed the barrier, and it goes. And sometimes you have one, sometimes you have two, sometimes you have 100, and you start seeing that, and it happens randomly every now and then. So there where you can see the shot noise effect. And especially in the high gain transistors, if you think about the Darlington pair, for example, the base current can be relatively small, and still you have high output current in the collector of that system. So if this shot noise, we are dealing with really small current values at the base of that kind of thing. And every now and then you have a, let's say you have Darlington pair that both of the transistors have a gain of 100. So in total it has a current gain of 10,000. So if you have one electron at the base moving through the barrier and through the p-n junction, it will be multiplied by 10,000. So in the collector you have 10,000 electrons moving. And so that's even more stronger place, or where you can see this effect. And you have to take that into account, and sometimes it can pose some problems in the application. Then yet another quite common noise source, or noise, how to say, well, noise source or type of noise is 1/F noise. And 1/F noise is quite interesting noise type. Well, the power spectrum, so the probability of different frequencies, it goes 1/frequency. So the lower frequencies are more probable than the higher frequencies, and they call 1/F. That's where the name comes from. And it's also called as a pink noise, so referring to pink. So you have more of the low frequencies, which means low frequency is high wavelength, so red. But you still have some of the high frequencies, so small wavelengths, which means that you have some blue. So in the end, this 1 over f would look like, in colors, it would look like a pink color. So that way that name comes from. So if you compare to white noise, where all the frequencies, all the wavelengths are equally probable, then you have all, it looks like white in color. So that's the reference to different colors in these noises. So what it means to have a noise power 1 over f probability. So if you think about 1 over f, so now we have log scale. So y axis in decibels, and x scale is in frequency, and it's in log scale. So because decibels, you remember that is defined by the log function. So now if we take a 1 over f noise source, and we look at different energy range, no, frequency ranges of that noise source. So if we take one frequency range, so let's, for example, here is in the blue color, we have from 10 to 100 hertz, so 1 decade. Then we integrate that power, so how much noise there is in that bandwidth, and then we take another bandwidth from 1,000 to 10,000 hertz. Those match, so they are the same areas. So even though they look different, so it, looking from here, just not paying attention to the scales, it looks like the left-hand area is bigger than the right-hand area. But if you think about that, we go in the left-hand one, we go from 10 to 100, so it's about 90 hertz in x-axis, and in the right-hand side, we go from 1,000 to 10,000. That's 900, no, 9,000 hertz. Then that's the difference. So the x-axis is much wider in reality. So if it would be more pronounced if it would make this a linear scale, but then this would not look as nice. But anyhow, so this 1 over f noise, how it behaves. So the power spectrum is kind of equal in different ranges of frequency. If we take the same kind of in log scale, in the same, like if we go to 1 octave or if we go 1 decade, then the ratio is the same. Then the 1 over f noise is kind of a general term for different types of noise. So one form of 1 over f noise is a flicker noise. And flicker noise is in semiconductors, it is caused by the random variations in diffusion of charge carriers within device. So diffusion is something that when you have some stuff, so whether it's some gas somewhere, or whether it's charge carriers, and you have bunch of them somewhere, they tend to go places where there are not that many of them. So the differences in distribution tend to kind of even out. So if you put gas in a chamber in one side of the chamber, over time the whole chamber will kind of have evenly distributed amount of that gas. The same goes with charge carriers. So if you put charge carriers in one place of the semiconductor, if you don't have any electric fields, they tend to start even out and find places where there are not that many of them, and in time there will be even distribution of those charge carriers. And of course that is random process when it happens. So it's not kind of, they are not kind of, if you take a bunch of charge carriers, they don't kind of decide at once, okay, I will go in that corner and you will go that corner and so on. And it happens immediately. But they start wandering around and they will start finding their place, and eventually they find a kind of even distribution. So it's a random walk type of thing. And that random walk and the variations in the random variations produces this flicker noise in these semiconductors. And also there are other forms of 1/f noise is that the resistance in devices is not equal. So the current itself can affect. So if you take a resistor, for example, or moreover, if you take a semiconductor, p-n junction or a channel or something, and we put current through it, the resistor along the way of the charge carriers, when they move, it's not, there's certain kind of average value for that, but along the way it can vary. And it can vary also so that when the charge carriers move, they locally they produce some changes in that kind of effective resistance in that local position, and that fluctuates, and that produces this flicker noise, which is 1/f. So you can see that when you measure really accurately the noise, and you measure the frequency distribution of that noise, you start seeing an 1/f features in that. But to know that you have to make the measurements are not easy to make, so you have to have a good setup to measure this kind of noise sources and noise in general. Because we'll talk about the electromagnetic compatibility later on, and those produce they can produce much more higher noise sources and kind of not random but necessarily but problems in this signal. So but the one interesting thing about 1/f, so it has been found out that it's really integral part of nature. So 1/f noise, you can find the behavior practically everywhere in nature. So if we measure fluctuation in tide and river heights, for example, so how the tide goes up and down, but they don't go always the same amount up and same amount down. So if you measure it and you measure a long time and you start kind of filling in the data and you start seeing that how it behaves and how what type of fluctuations there are, you end up having a 1/f behavior in that. Same goes with quasar. If you measure the light from quasars, the emissions they fluctuate, and you when you measure and gather data and look at the this fluctuation, you will find that it's 1/f behavior. Heartbeat, so if you measure a beat by beat, the length of the heartbeat, you start seeing fluctuations, and they have this 1/f tendency. Neurons, so in the brains, single neurons, if one would look at one single neuron and see how often it fires a signal, again you will start seeing 1/f tendency there. And the resistivity in solid state electronics, as I mentioned, the flicker noise in solid state electronics. So it's practically all over the place, this 1/f noise. So it's really interesting phenomenon, and there's a lot of research done on this all of these different features and different parts of nature. So it's quite interesting subject. So just to illustrate the kind of the difference between 1/f and white noise. So if we this is just a random example, but just to kind of illustrate how they differ. So 1/f on top, you can see that there is this high frequency noise, that there's this the signal is going up and down. So there's no signal here. Both should be flat. So there's like zero signal. So just noise. And you can see that 1/f, it kind of you have this kind of a small or low frequency going up and down in average, but then you have on top of that you have this high frequency like events, and so you have kind of there is this more it's more profound that the low frequency components than the high frequency. Whereas for white noise, you have both, so you have the high frequency. And then you can see the low frequency. There are some low frequency parts, but they are equal. So there's no kind of more, there's not weight on high frequencies or low frequencies. The probability is equal for white noise. So that's kind of the difference, how they look like. So here's an illustration of how the power density, the noise power density spectrum would look like when you measure it. So you would take a bunch of data, and then you would make a fast Fourier transform or Fourier transform to that, and you will find different frequency components of that signal. And then for white noise or thermal noise, and or shot noise, it would be flat. So all the frequencies are as probable as any other. And for 1/f noise, you would have this that high the lower frequencies are more probable. So you would have this kind of kink going up at low frequencies. But when you go higher frequencies, then the 1/f noise kind of goes down 1/f as the name implies. But then the thermal, so the white noise stays equal. So at some point, the white noise becomes dominating. So that's why you have usually you will see when you measure the noise spectrum, you have this kind of behavior as the green one gives. So at high frequencies, you will see a steady, stable probabilities for noise, and then at low frequencies you have this 1/f noise. So if you would like to learn about this 1/f noise at high frequency, you would need to take this thermal noise and shot noise, this white noise, as low as possible. So you would need to reduce the temperature in order to get rid of the thermal noise as much as possible. Of course, reduce the resistance of the system in order to reduce. And then you would need to increase the current, because then you would need to you would in because then relatively you would have more and more of the signal, not the noise. But that's another kind of field of study and research that we are not going into detail how to measure this, but it's just good to know that this how what are the different components in noise. Okay, then about the interference. So now we've been talking about kind of the natural noise sources that you practically cannot get rid of at all. So you always have them present. So they are always there. You can control the amount or the magnitude of those noise sources to a certain extent, but you cannot totally get rid of them. The other type of noise or interference to the actual signals is like electromagnetic interference. So that's something that when you have an electronic system, let's say you have an amplifier, then you have some external systems that can emit electromagnetic radiation, and then your system picks that up and it might amplify it, or you just see it as a noise in your system. And it can take many forms, and it can enter the system at any state, input states or the output states, or somewhere in between. And it depends on the system design and the geometries and so on, what is the most probable place that interference comes in to your system. So common sources for this interference is radio transmitters. So you have these beacons there that transmits radio. So you have Radio Rock and Suomi Pop and whatever, and those, so they emit electromagnetic radiation, and it depends on how sensitive your system is in order to pick that up. If it's a radio receiver, then that's fine, but then sometimes you are doing something else and you don't want to pick that those signals. And of course, it depends on how close to that transmitter you are and so on. AC power cables. So you have, for example, this 50 hertz signal that is in the walls everywhere, basically. And that emits 50 hertz radio or electromagnetic radiation all the time. And that can be picked up by your system. Lightning is something. So if lightning strikes somewhere, it can induce electromagnetic waves, which then induce some currents in your system, depending on what type of system you are, and it might even break your device. Or so earlier days, there was a lot of videos and TVs broken whenever there was a lightning strike somewhere in close by. So these can be reduced, the effect, by shielding the cables and putting these kind of ferrite coils in the cable, so that you reduce the spikes that the lightning strikes induce in the cables, power cables. Switching transients of nearby equipment. So if you have equipment that goes on and off, so some motor, for example, that it just switches on and off, it produces some electromagnetic noise that your system can pick up. Mechanical vibrations, it can produce electrical noise. So you have a pump that vibrates in a certain frequency. You can pick that up in your electrical system, depending on what type of system. Of course, if you have mechanical sensors, those sense the vibration, and that can mess up your system. Light can affect, so depending on what type of system you have, the light can induce, and of course that's problem in optical sensors if you have those. And then just unintentional coupling of inside your system. So you have a complex system that you have different amplifiers and you have different parts do different things, and then they are close by in a circuit board, and one part of your subsystem is doing something, and it gets coupled to the rest of the circuit by stray capacitance or inductance effects, and it can mess up the behavior. So that is something that you can do just by yourself, and you need to take care of that by yourself when you are designing things. But there are some things that you don't necessarily notice when you are designing. If you are simulating things in a circuit simulator, you don't necessarily find out these type of things in a circuit simulator, because the circuit simulator don't understand these kind of things if you are not explicitly telling them the amount of stray capacitances and inductances in the system. And of course, those are hard to tell if you haven't measured them. So it's kind of a chicken and an egg problem, that you don't know necessarily the problem before you are actually experiencing the problem. So that's why many times you need to make a few prototypes in order to find out what are the problems, and then go back and then find out what is the piece that is making the problem. So it's very rarely you get a design to work at the first try. Okay, so representing noise equivalent circuits, as I already mentioned, that the noise source can be simply in, if you think about voltage noise, like the thermal noise, for example, you just put it in parallel with your voltage sources that you have, or the resistors. Or if you have a current, like the short noise case, then you put that, you use the Norton equivalent circuit for it. So you can make these equivalent circuits using either Thevenin's or Norton's equivalent circuits, and get kind of, you can represent the noise sources using these features, and it's relatively simple to add in the system. So amplifier with noise. So of course we have resistors involved, and in amplifier, the noise affects the most of the output signal if the noise is coupled in the input, because it goes through the whole chain of amplifier. If you get the noise picked up by the amplifier at the late stage, or the output stage, it not necessarily affect that much. So that's why it's, you have to design as low input states, so no low noise input states as possible. So again, this is something that you don't want to use too high resistors in the input states, because you will increase the thermal noise because of the high resistors. And then in the input states, if you have high resistors, high thermal noise, that thermal noise will be amplified in your amplifier to the output states, and of course it will mess up the integrity of the signal. And of course, as noticed in the previous chapter, the operational amplifier, it has bunch of transistors, bunch of resistors, bunch of everything, and all of them have some sort of noise source, or you can think of like different noise sources to all of them. But of course, you don't want to start modeling by adding all the noise sources in individual places and do it accurately. Like, of course, if you have time and you really want to do it accurately, but it's not always the kind of the purpose to do it. So you could model the amplifier as we have done so far. We make an kind of a equivalent circuit of the amplifier, and then we add a kind of a effective noise source to the kind of which represents all the noise sources within that amplifier, because it's every anyway, it's in kind of estimation that how much there is, and how, because it's really hard or impossible even to find out exactly what level of noise there is in a certain transistor within a operational amplifier. So you have a kind of a weighted average of all of them, and you can model it by that way. So what are the kind of the dominating noise sources in different transistors? So in bipolar transistors, of course, there are many types of noise, but thermal noise is one of the dominating ones in bipolar transistors. So you have this P and N regions that have some finite resistance, and they will have the thermal noise within them. But also you have the short noise, because of you have these PN junctions. And then the diffusion processes produce free. So you have all of them in bipolar transistors. So flicker noise, which is 1/f, then you have shot noise because of the PN junctions and the fluctuation of carriers across the junctions, and then thermal noise in the resistance parts of the. And the most dominating one is not easy to say, but in general, what would be the most dominating one, because it depends on the geometry of the device, it depends on the doping levels and so on. So it has to be kind of considered one by one, case by case. So we could build a transistor model. So we have this H parameter model that we discussed earlier, and in order to take the noise sources into a question, we can just simply add here a shot noise contribution, which is the base to emitter PN junction. Then we have the thermal noise, which is for the resistor value, and also here we have the 1/f, the flicker noise. We could add both of them in this voltage source here, and this could we could attribute some values to these and see how the behavior is in general. 1/f field effect transistors, the noise is usually dominated by flicker noise at low frequencies, especially because flicker noise is 1/f. And thermal noise is resulted by the result of the resistance of the channel. The shot noise is not that significant usually, because we don't have any junctions in the MOSFET to in normal operation. And in JFETs, there are a little bit more shot noise than in MOSFETs because we have the PN junctions, but that part is usually not that big of a problem because we are dealing with the reverse bias. So flicker noise is the most dominating one, but then of course at high frequencies thermal noise becomes more dominating. So it is 1/f, and then white noise. At some point, thermal noise will become more dominating. Signal to noise ratio. So this kind of so S and R value. So it kind of measures the signal purity in a way that how much what is the ratio of the signal to the noise, as the name applies. So if we think about the power of the signal and the power of the noise, so we take the power spectrum of the noise, and then we take the power spectrum of the signal, and then we take the ratio and we get the S and R value. So again, we need to think about the certain bandwidth. So we think about that we have an audio amplifier or audio signal, which is bandwidth is 20 kilohertz. So how much noise there is in 20 kilohertz, and how much the actual signal is in average, and what's the ratio? So how much noise we hear or we can see among the actual signal. Of course, the larger the number, the better the we can differentiate the signal from the noise. So if this is zero, then signal and noise, they have the same amplitude in average, same power, and you cannot differentiate the signal from the noise if you don't know more about the signal. Some cases there are some clever tricks to pick out the actual signal if you know what type of frequencies you are dealing with. So you know the input frequency. You can use a login amplifier and look into those particular frequencies, and you can kind of pick. Even you have if you have high noise, you can still kind of find out about the signal and amplitudes of the signal. But then you are kind of narrowing the bandwidth, so you are not taking a wide bandwidth, but you are taking just one frequency. Then of course the noise power is reduced, and the signal to noise ratio is improved. Just saying this before we stop. So if we have more than one noise source in question, like in case of if we have a thermal noise and then 1/f noise, then we don't just sum them up like arithmetically. So we need to have this square root or sum of squares and the square root of square of sums. Sum of squares, which way it is? Square root of sum of squares. That's the way to say. So because they are independent to each other, and they are random, so we just cannot sum them up like they are. But we have to take we consider that they are kind of orthonormal to each other, and this is the way to sum them up. Okay. I will continue from here on Monday then. So, is there any questions arised from these two chapters so far? If not, then we will continue next Monday, and see you then. Bye bye.